Hello, and welcome to Economics for Rebels, the podcast of the European Society for Ecological Economics. Up until recently, it was an act of rebellion to pursue economics as if nature mattered and the earth was finite. This rebellion must bring a major shift to economic thinking. Our podcast is dedicated to exploring the economics of just and sustainable transformations in conversations with scientists, experts, activists, pushing for rapid and radical change for people and planet.
Welcome to our podcast. I'm today's host, Sufosu Amgyasan, and you're listening to the Economics for Rebels podcast. So, one of the things that a big chunk of us ecological economists do is teach, and it's pretty rewarding as you get to play with and pass on ideas that inspired us. But it's also pretty complicated, not only because ecological economics is necessarily interdisciplinary, but also because there's a certain amount of unlearning conventional narratives you have to do first before you can really get stuck in. So it's a great pleasure to welcome Corinne Bolcom onto the show. Corinne is a senior lecturer in ecological economics at the Scottish Rural College, affiliated with the University of Edinburgh, where she's been running one of Europe's largest ecological economics programs for most of the last decade. And full disclosure, she's also the pretty epic lecturer and academic who got me and many of my colleagues into ecological economics in the first place years ago. Welcome, Corinne.
Hi, Sophus. Thanks for having me.
Corinne, what's your favorite thing about teaching ecological economics?
Well, this is a great question. I think there are many things that I love teaching about ecological economics. And the overarching theme that unites the more specific answer I'll give is that teaching, for me, is a pathway to impact, to making a positive difference both in the world and hopefully in the lives of my students. And I mean this very genuinely. I know it might sound a little cheesy, but I do mean it genuinely. Ecological economics as a field focuses on some of the most important challenges that are facing the world, both environmentally and socially. And so as someone teaching in this field, I get to help equip students to go out into the world in whatever ways they can contribute to addressing those challenges. And as you said, this is really rewarding. And I mean, it's awesome, frankly. And I think it's also very important as well. You know, each person that we train as educators goes out into the world and they make their mark in their own way. They interact with countless other people. They take knowledge and competencies and perspectives that they've gained in formal education, and they build on them, they develop them, they use them, they share them. And this is a diffuse but incredible force for change in the world. And I'm very fortunate to be able to work in an environment where the value of that is not overlooked. And in terms of the students themselves, the MSc program that I run was originally set up as a kind of transitional master's program. This means that we very often have and explicitly support students who are looking to make pretty radical changes in their life trajectories. And ecological economics as a field, being so interdisciplinary, it kind of innately encourages that as well. You know, students come across new parts of the field, totally new ideas, and this opens up, you know, like a world of possibility. And so my role as program director and as a teacher, in those roles, I get to help people develop and act on the goals that they have set for themselves in relation to their own development. And I really appreciated educators who had that kind of mindset when I was going through school. And I think it's a privilege to get to inhabit that role for others. And it's an aspect of teaching that's very close to my heart. You know, there's little better than seeing a student succeed in a goal that they've set for themselves that somehow seemed out of reach at the start of the learning process.
Yeah, great answer. And what's your favorite bit of ecological economics to teach?
Well, this is a tough question because I do like a lot of it. But presently, I think there's a two-course sequence that stands out to me in our program. And collectively, I'll say that this kind of sequence is my favorite bit to teach, at least for now. So the first course in the sequence is our Foundations in Ecological Economics course. And it's where we teach students about the concepts and ideas of ecological economics. It's where we address the question, what even is ecological economics? What is it all about? And it's where we start to cultivate some of those analytical skills that students need to be able to move between and to draw together different disciplines. Teaching this course is great, not only because the material is so interesting, but also because it's the start of the students' journey towards becoming ecological economists. You know, so it really sets the tone for the rest of the program. And the second course in the sequence is our field methods course. And this is a problem-based learning course. And before I go into any detail on that, I really want to give a shout out to my fellow ecological economists at the University of Vermont for all of the advice and perspective that they shared with me. Years ago, I reached out to them after having read Joshua Farley's book on problem-based learning in ecological economics. And he and UVM colleagues, you know, they inspired me. They helped me set this course up in the first place. And, you know, we work in very different institutional contexts and the details of our specific course designs reflect that. But, you know, their expertise was invaluable. So anyway, back to our field methods course. You know, the purpose of this course is to give students guided professional practice in what it means to be ecological economists. And we start the class by posing a research question to the students. And this research question relates to a multidimensional sustainability challenge that exists somewhere in the world. And wherever possible, the question comes from external stakeholders that we know who have an unmet research need that is unlikely to be addressed by local funding bodies. We then mentor the students, who are organized into interdisciplinary and multicultural teams, on how to develop a project idea that would make some degree of progress towards answering that research question. And this leads into the students producing formal academic proposals. We read and evaluate those proposals and consider, you know, what is actually feasible. And then we kind of come back to the class with a project brief or a couple of project briefs and explain what we're actually going to do. And in that process of moving from proposals to actual plans, we try to keep as many of the different ideas that the students have come up with as possible. We then give students the training they need to kind of bring those projects to life, to undertake them for real. And the class culminates in a study tour where we go out into the field and we actually implement those projects, collect novel primary data, and the students are kind of in the driver's seat leading that as much as possible. And then in its current form, the class kind of ends with students sharing the outcomes of their work with the people who inspired and participated in those projects to begin with. And this involves more than students just presenting their work, but they actually curate the insights they've gained in formats that we can like hand out and that would be explicitly useful to others once we go home. So this academic year, for example, the class completed 3 small projects in Spain. As a part of the course, we collaborated with the Center for Open Learning at the University of Edinburgh so that students could receive introductory Spanish lessons during the course. The materials produced by the students at the end, which we have shared with our hosts in Spain, include a community voice video highlighting the experiences of women with rural change, a whiteboard animation explaining the perspectives found through a case study that was focused on large-scale renewable energy projects, and a magazine piece reflecting the key insights learned from a board game which the students created themselves to understand the perceptions that exist in relation to how land use change affects well-being and local conceptions of the good life. And we gave 2 copies of that board game itself to our collaborators in Spain as well. And I mean, this was incredible. The students did such a good job. And I think I speak on behalf of the entire teaching team for the course when I say that it'd be hard for us to be, you know, more proud of how they did. And as you can imagine, there are many things that I love about this course. But to name just a few, you know, it brings ecological economics to life. It's an especially powerful way to bring concepts to life like systems complexity and value pluralism, ethics, knowledge co-production, power dynamics, justice. Students also develop tremendously in terms of their capabilities over the course of the semester where this course happens. Most come into the class never having had the opportunity to do primary research of any kind at all, and then leave the course having competently and collaboratively delivered like the entire arc of an ecological economics research project, inhabiting the role in that entire process of you know, an ecological economist. It's also a course that I think is really neat because it itself like comes into being, it comes to life as the students come up with their ideas and take their decisions. And this feels really different to everyone, including to teaching staff, than courses where you can chart out at the beginning of the semester exactly where it's going to go. I hope it's a vehicle through which the MSc program may be able in some small way to make its own kind of positive contribution towards addressing real-world sustainability challenges. So I think those two together, for me, are my favorite bits, and they kind of form what I see as the backbone of our MSc program in its current form.
Yeah, brilliant. So as a lecturer, you're a gatekeeper to the kind of ecological economics people are exposed to, from, you know, broad generalizations here the US school, more ecosystem service focused, ecological economics, to the European school, more radical ecological economics. How do you pick which ideas, perspectives, and actually, you know, formal methods to expose new students to?
In short, I would say it's through a mix of principle and pragmatism. And I can kind of elaborate on each of those. In terms of principle, I feel very strongly that it's not my job as an educator to tell students what like kind of ecological economist to be. And the different philosophical positions that exist in our field exist as they do because we work on wicked problems that are embedded in complex socio-ecological systems that are characterized by deep uncertainty, and that as a consequence defy a kind of one-size-fits-all approach to resolving them. And so for me, it's kind of like this, you know, in a world of complex problems, who am I or who are any of us to dictate to our students what specific perspectives they should adopt or employ? So I don't do that. I would feel like I was kind of violating my students' intellectual autonomy, and I would also see that as being kind of counter to the pluralism that is really important within the field. And so the consequence of this is that I don't filter information or methods specifically to try and lead students into becoming one kind of ecological economist or the other. And I'm very explicit with students about the fact that I hold this position. Instead, what I do is try and expose students to the field at large, and then I try and hold them accountable for engaging in critical thinking, you know, about the implications of different ideas, concepts, theories, methods. And also I try and hold them accountable for engaging in metacognition in relation to like their own self-perceptions as ecological economists. You know, where are they at in the field and why? And I find the labels that Spash came up with, these kind of designations of social ecological economist, environmental pragmatist, new resource economist, are very helpful in this process. So, you know, I share these labels and the intellectual discussions around them with students, and then we have this kind of convenient shared vocabulary for discussing the different positions that people may have. But I make it really clear that neither I nor the program as a whole has any agenda as to which of these is best. You know, the program needs to be like an open place for people to explore all the different parts of the field. And my goal for students is that they each gain enough clarity to identify a position that seems meaningful to them. Ideally, I'd like them to be able to explain whatever position it is that they've adopted by articulating how it relates to the rest of the field. And I want them to understand the conceptual, methodological, and practical implications of the position that they've chosen. I'd also encourage students to avoid territoriality so that they remain open to kind of refining and updating their position as they get new experiences and learn new things. But as long as they get to that point, then I'm kind of happy. So that's the kind of principle part of my answer. But of course, pragmatism is also important. I don't really like the notion of being a gatekeeper. You know, I don't really want to be like an intellectual bouncer. I don't want to be an obstacle standing like between my students and different ideas or methods, you know, like letting some things in and actively keeping other things out. But at the same time, constraints are real. There are only so many hours in a week, so many weeks in a semester, so many semesters in a program. There's only so many members of staff who can teach, and there are only so many facilities available. Members of staff, they're humans in their own right. They have skills and areas of expertise, and they have areas of comfort. And so, you know, all of this needs to kind of be balanced. And we need to balance all those things in a way that enables people from all sorts of different backgrounds to make really good progress in ecological economics over a relatively short period of time. So as someone designing and leading courses in this kind of context, the reality is that I have to make choices about, you know, what to cover and what not to cover. It's absolutely impossible to cover everything. So given that these kind of constraints exist, I think I prefer to think of myself as like an intellectual scout, maybe, rather than an intellectual bouncer. Try and remain agile rather than like formidably defending a particular position. And I try to use my understanding of the constraints that exist for the program, my understanding of how people learn, and then I kind of like try and travel ahead of students within the field so that I can, to run with this scouting metaphor, like come back and meet them where they are at, and then try and facilitate them in having as productive a learning journey as possible within the constraints that exist and given the time that we have together. So in practice in the program, I do this by continually broadening my own areas of understanding in the field, by covering concepts and methods that are relevant to each of the three major positions that I talked about before, the labels that Spash came up with. I do this by making the links between concepts, methods, and these different positions explicit, and by paying careful attention to the learning environments that I design. I want my learning environments to both like model for students and help students become aware of like learning how to learn new things. I think this is a key part of trusting your own capability. And I also really want to create environments that encourage students to take ownership over their own journey towards becoming ecological economists. And a key part of that is giving students meaningful choice about the knowledge and skills that they develop throughout the year, while trying to help them not lose sight of the bigger picture. And then I'd also say it's important that my colleagues and I build opportunities into the program for students practicing a range of skills that will support them in their like continuing development beyond graduation. And I don't just mean kind of like soft skills or professional skills like teamwork. I mean, we have that too. But what I'm specifically thinking of here is reflection, synthesis, and critical thinking. And whatever else students learn, these skills can really help newly minted ecological economists in like chartering a course for themselves in the field after graduation. And I think this last point, the need for students to be able to effectively charter a course for themselves, is really important. You know, for a student taking any degree, and that includes a degree in ecological economics, of course, those degrees are just like a launch pad. They're not a finish line. And so that transition from student to not student and graduation ceremonies and everything, it can hide that. But I think it's true. You know, graduation is the start of the rest of a person's life as much as it is like the end of a particular period of training. And so if students are going to make the best use of what a program has to offer, they need to know that they are capable of driving that forwards on their own terms and in different environments and circumstances after their formal time on the program has ended. And I think that, you know, reflection, synthesis, and critical thinking are really key to being able to do this.
And where do you fall on the idea that we should teach young ecological economists some neoclassical economics so that they have an understanding they can critique versus kind of carving out our own paradigm?
Well, this is a really interesting question. And, you know, my thoughts on this have evolved like considerably since I started teaching. So I came into ecological economics from a natural sciences background, marine science specifically, and not from an economics background. So as an ecological economics student, you know, I didn't have to unlearn anything from mainstream economics, but I still very much wanted neoclassical economics to somehow like come into focus. I wanted to have it come into focus so I could see clearly the distinctions between ecological economics and mainstream economics. I wanted to understand why neoclassical economics was the way it was, and what was specifically being challenged by ecological economics and why. I wanted to be able to evaluate those arguments carefully for myself. And I also worried about being able to engage with mainstream economists, you know, if I didn't know anything about mainstream economics. So for me, when I was a student, ecological economics existed almost as like a field in contrast. It needed somehow neoclassical economics and that contrast to be clear. And as someone teaching ecological economics, at least at the start, I knew that students would come into the program feeling at least vaguely similar to how I felt. And my early design choices in teaching, particularly foundations in ecological economics, reflected this. You know, like I think when you were a student on the program, for example, I would try and establish what the mainstream perspective was on a topic in order for that perspective to serve as a foil to the ecological economics perspective. And like I hope this would give context to the ecological economics position and to make it clear how significant the ecological economics position was. I hoped that this would bring some of mainstream economics into focus for people who, you know, came from a non-economics background. I wanted to give people some confidence in challenging mainstream economics. And also for people who had studied economics as undergrads, I hope this would give them like a nice and easy way in to like refining in a targeted way their understanding of economics so that, you know, ecological economics could kind of overlay what they had studied before. But, you know, over time, I became pretty dissatisfied with that approach. I always felt there was a kind of like strangeness to this strategy, kind of unease. And that didn't resolve with different approaches that I took to actually like delivering that kind of content. And so that made me wonder if that was really like the best way to do things. And I've come to feel that at least in the context I teach in, that it's not the best way. What I now feel is that if we want to make the case that neoclassical economics shouldn't be the default form of economics, and in fact that it doesn't need to be the default form because there are viable alternatives, then we should just stop presenting neoclassical economics as the default in the classroom. And you know, yet when I look back at my older practice, that is exactly what I was doing. I was presenting neoclassical economics first, and asking people to understand that, and then asking them to contrast ecological economics to that. So I think it's really important now that we need to make clear that ecological economics isn't a field that exists just in contrast. So now I teach in a way that focuses on establishing ecological economics in its own right for my students. And my goal is for ecological economics to come into focus as much as possible, to make that as clear as I can. And my hope and intention is that, you know, the more confident students are in their understanding of what ecological economics is, and maybe what it is not, the more ownership they will be able to take over their own positions in the field. And, you know, since making this switch, that sense of unease that I described earlier has completely gone away. And I think that I observe students gaining more ecological economics competencies faster than under my old way of teaching. And I think it's because this approach has resolved that internal inconsistency that comes from teaching one thing, only to ask students to immediately unlearn it in favor of another thing. And, you know, saying out loud, maybe that seems a little bit self-evident, but, you know, it's been a process to get to this point. And one of the benefits of this new approach that I have, besides, I think, giving students clear areas in which to focus their energies, is it also brings more into focus some of the gaps that exist in the field. And these kind of areas can in turn become the things that students choose to focus on in their dissertation research or future careers. The major trade-off, of course, is that it leaves this task of critical comparison and contrast with neoclassical economics to each individual as a kind of, you know, post-graduation challenge. And I guess I'm hoping that engaging in that kind of challenge will actually be easier to pursue with confidence when students believe that they have a really solid foundation in ecological economics. But you know, I guess time will tell, and I'm sure alumni will let me know over time if that's how things pan out.
Okay, so from my experience, you teach ecological economics incredibly well. Do you mind taking us on a journey through the kind of teaching methods you've used to teach ecological economics over the last decade?
Yeah, sure. So I think the first thing I'll say is just that for me, using backwards design is pretty central to my approach. And it kind of doesn't matter what other stuff is going on in the classroom. I always try and use backwards design. Specific theories of learning or models of learning might have different versions of this, but the general idea is the same. So, you know, as the name suggests, you start by articulating the endpoints you want to get to, and you could frame those as learning objectives or competencies or capability objectives. And the key thing is that, like, that we have to be really specific at that stage. Because once you know, we articulate those endpoints, then what you do is imagine that learning happens in phases and try and commit everything in the course to being in service of those end objectives. So this means you have to ask yourself what needs to happen in the last phase, for example, of a course or a program or a specific class, in order for the students to make that final leap to reach those desired endpoints that you've articulated. And once that is clear, then you need to take one more step back and ask what needs to happen in the second to last phase in order for students to be where they need to be in the last phase of the course to then make that leap to the final endpoints that you want them to get to. And you basically work your way backwards like that until you realize you have reached, in fact, the start of this thing that you're going to be delivering. And of course, learning isn't linear like that as students experience it, but going through this process of backwards design can really illuminate the kinds of dependencies that exist in learning. And that means there's a fantastic opportunity to build a coherent learning arc and to really consider carefully how all the different things that are involved with teaching, you know, class time, lectures, assignments, field trips, how they can all work together to help create that learning arc. And I think I have a quote that expresses the goal of backwards design really well. It's from Nick Shackleton-Jones. He's written, "A simple way to improve education is as follows. We ask, for what purpose? And then we say, so let's teach that instead."
Yeah, brilliant. So do you mind talking us through an example of this in the classroom?
Sure. So say, for example, that I want my students to be able to pick up new methods as they move into working on new problems with confidence. I want them to be able to know what that task involves and have the skills to be able to do that. Well, that means I probably need to model for them the process of learning about new methods multiple times over the course of that learning arc. And for that to happen, it means I need to identify methods that can be taught, and we can make reasonable progress in teaching anyway, in relatively short periods of time, because otherwise we won't get that repeated practice of learning how to learn about new methods. And also I can think that when students are working on these research projects that I want them to be capable of adapting to in the future, I know they're going to be working with people from different disciplines and different cultures, because we don't normally work as isolated individuals. So along this, as a part of learning to learn about new methods, students also have to learn how to build functional teams. And I know that it's very common in education for these teams to have, for students to have bad experiences in teams. So there can be a lot of distrust. So we need to find a way to kind of stack the odds in favor of teams being functional and successful, so that students can really learn how to operate in teams well. And so we kind of work backwards from these endpoints and look for something that has these ways to support functional teams and a pattern of work that would allow us to have a repeated interaction of students and methods, so that they can learn how to learn about new methods, and along the way also pick up specific things about methods themselves. And this might lead us to making a team-based learning course that focuses specifically on learning about ecological economics methods. And we would pick methods that fit conveniently into nice little packaged sessions. And that means that some of the larger, more complicated methods wouldn't fit in this course. But if the course achieves its objective, students can pick those up later when they need to by building on the foundation that this course would give them. And this is what we do in our applications in ecological economics course.
Yeah, perfect. So there's probably quite a few ecological economics lecturers listening. Do you mind going over really quickly how we deal with the free rider problem in team-based learning?
Yeah, well, absolutely. Team-based learning is a fascinating approach, and I highly recommend that anybody who's interested Google this. There's like a lot of resources online, and the people who came up with this are, you know, exceptionally clever. So there's all kinds of small policies and parts of team-based learning that are there specifically to stack the odds in favor of teams working well together instead of being dysfunctional. So for example, there are policies about hiring and firing. So if somebody is on a team full of free riders, they can leave that team. If there's one free rider on a team, that teammate can be fired. This can't happen arbitrarily. It always has to involve the kind of course organizer or lead lecturer. But the point is, by having those policies, they provide a safety net. That safety net makes it easier for students to take the risk of extending a little bit of trust to others. There are also policies to build in accountability. So a key part of team-based learning is this thing called the readiness assurance process. And there is an individual quiz and a team quiz that are a part of that. And these quizzes are small and they are low stakes, but they are very visible. So it becomes clear to a person how much progress they're making, and it becomes clear to their team how much progress they're making. And students start to see that the team can, as a whole, when everybody tries well, accomplish much more than an individual on their own. And it creates just a sort of gentle social pressure to deliver what a student needs to deliver for the team. There's also an appeals process that is a part of team-based learning, where you try and sort of create opportunities for the team as a whole to pull together and make a case to get more points. So you intentionally build into this readiness assurance process some ambiguities, some opportunities for argumentation. Again, this is about pulling the team together. Overarching all of this is the concept of team citizenship. And in your kind of repeated evaluations, teams will get team-based marks, you know, and that becomes individualized on the basis of peer and self-review that focuses exclusively on team citizenship. And as a course organizer, you need to moderate those to make sure that people are actually filling in these peer and self-evaluations in good faith. But what all of this does is it's There are both reminders, nudges, incentives, rewards, all kind of pointing in the same direction, which is if you choose to be a part of a team in a functional way, then and all of your teammates make the same choice, then your team is going to accomplish a lot. So I think that, you know, all of those little different protective measures mean that it's much more common for teams to have really good experiences in team-based learning than it is for them to have bad experiences. And if a student finds themselves in one of these more exceptional cases where things aren't going well, they're not stuck in that position. They can quickly get out of it. We move them into a more productive environment and they continue learning. So it's just, you know, all those little things, all the little features that you add in and build into your classroom environment as a part of team-based learning, create an environment where it's easy for teams to be successful and functional. It's fantastic.
So ecological economics is pretty hard, and there are bits I still don't get after 7 years of working in this area. Which bits do students most struggle with, and how can you teach those bits well?
Yeah, I mean, you're right. It is very hard. And I think one answer I could give relates to like specific concepts or methods. I mean, people do struggle with those things, but I think that's very individualized. So like in a more general sense, I think there are some maybe bigger picture things that people struggle with. And one is just the breadth and scope of the field. I mean, ecological economics makes use of an enormous variety of concepts and integrates them in novel ways with each other. It's open to an incredibly wide array of research methods. There is never just like one absolutely unambiguously right answer to something. The field embraces complexity instead of assuming that complexity away. There are numerous ways a person can be an ecological economist. And so like this is a wide and open space for people to be operating in. And that can be really overwhelming. And it becomes very easy for students to become lost in all of the things that they haven't yet learned and to really lose sight of the progress that they have made. You know, a student can end up feeling adrift in a sea of an infinitely large field. And that's not very empowering. I'd say it's the opposite of feeling empowered. And so the program itself, we need to like combat this. We need to kind of find ways to anchor students in the progress that they have been making. And so part of how we do this is we design courses in a way that model for students how to break down different kinds of complex learning tasks into smaller pieces. Students always get the opportunity to practice a new skill more than once. We also are very explicit with students about the fact that they will have to draw a line under their activities. It is not possible for them to know everything, to learn everything, to read everything. And so we need to like practice that skill of deciding when to stop. And we think carefully about where we want students to expend their energy and the purposes that to which they should be expending their energy. The second thing I think is that students can really struggle with the unlearning that you mentioned at the start of the podcast. And I think that unlearning is a big part of ecological economics. And it's not just students from an economics background who need to unlearn. And it's not just while you're a student that unlearning happens. You know, unlearning is not a small thing. It can be really tough. It can demand that we refine or update or completely overhaul a worldview that we, you know, held for an extended period of time and expended a lot of energy to build in the first place. So one of the things that we try and do to help with that is try and map ecological economics onto the real world to make it like feel real to people. Because I think once students see ecological economics reflected in the reality around them, unlearning feels a lot less destabilizing. And it becomes more like just understanding reality better. And the third thing, I think, is just being able to trust your own judgment in a completely new and very interdisciplinary territory. And so we have to build in practice for students to be able to exercise their own judgment so that if they come across another academic from a different discipline who just exudes confidence that they are right and that the ecological economist is wrong, that the students can kind of like resist that sense of doubt that can creep in. And we can't like make students completely immune to that kind of creeping doubt, but we can give them a kind of foundational set of practice in the kind of skills and developing of judgment that they need in order to do this over time.
So my experience was during the course, there were a number of light bulb moments where it totally changed the way I see the world. And these are always pretty fun. Which are the bits of ecological economics that from your experience trigger these like aha moments?
Yeah, those light bulb moments are really fun. They're fun to experience. And also like from a teaching perspective, I really like watching them happen. I think that there's a number of different kinds of situations that can prompt them. And it does kind of seem to depend on people's undergraduate backgrounds a little bit. So, you know, for example, it's pretty common for students with an engineering background to have one of those aha moments when they learn about entropy and thermodynamics of the economy. And I think it's because they had like almost all of those puzzle pieces already. And then ecological economics comes in with these few other additional observations and suddenly, whoosh, you know, this new picture comes completely into focus. And then we also tend to see them when we start to look more in depth at things that people have maybe just taken for granted previously. So like when we ask questions like, what is money and where does money really come from in economies, that tends to lead to a lot of light bulb moments and also a lot of like very confused faces. Another light bulb moment like that happens when students really think about what it means for economies to be embedded in societies that are in turn embedded within natural systems. And like as humans living on Earth, at some level, everyone knows economies are embedded like this because it's reality. But that doesn't mean that people have like consciously picked up that insight and started to like draw out all of the different implications of that being true. And so when they start to do that, you can get like a lot of light bulb moments. A lot of things can kind of click into place. And then, of course, there's just like new concepts that like people have never had a chance to come across before. And as soon as they have that, once they're armed with that kind of language, then these kind of new worlds of possibility open up. And so like uneconomic growth can do that. Systems thinking, leverage points, thinking about the distinction between relative and absolute decoupling, labeling different forms of justice and injustice. You know, these are just some of the examples that come to mind.
So what lessons do you think we can learn from this about how to capture the public imagination with the ideas of ecological economics?
This is a really challenging question, but I think it's important. And I would say I don't have like a very clear answer, maybe let's say a tentative answer, and I can share my sort of first tentative thoughts. So my first tentative thought is that I think there has to be some mileage in finding ways to make it clear to the general public that ecological economics is focused on understanding the complexities that the complex realities that people actually inhabit for the explicit purpose of helping to find ways to deliver a future that is sustainable and just. I think that message has really broad appeal. But unfortunately, I don't think that it's what people necessarily expect of economists. So I think we need to find some way of like dispelling those preconceptions that people have when they hear the economics part of ecological economics. And then my second tentative thought is I think it will probably be important for ecological economics to eventually present and make easily accessible like fully fledged alternative conceptions of the internal dynamics of economies, you know, how they are, how they could be, so that we can demonstrate unambiguously that it is possible to do so. So right now, for example, a student can't walk into a university bookstore, wander to the economics section, pick up an ecological economics textbook on a whim, and say, learn about supply and demand in a way that bypasses the layers of assumptions that ecological economists feel are irredeemably problematic, that is derived from contemporary data on real economies, that like foregrounds systems thinking and a dynamic conception of time, that reflects realistic heterogeneous human behavior, that integrates and reflects the material and energetic basis of the economy, that utilizes a more holistic perspective on well-being, and that is widely accepted in the field. And like, I totally understand why this fictional scenario that I've mapped out like doesn't happen today. But the thing is, conventional economics 101 exists and it's taught widely around the world. And so without like a clear and direct answer to that, I fear that there will always be a kind of barrier to the general public like unlearning some of the conceptions about economies and economics that they've picked up from mainstream economics. And you know, these barriers also seem likely to me to be barriers to the general public engaging with that full possibility space that we as ecological economists believe exists to create more sustainable and just futures.
So finally, I'll ask the question we always finish with. What is your rebellion?
Well, you know, being a regular listener, Sophus, I knew you were going to ask this question. And even with that warning, this is a hard question. I don't in general feel like a very rebellious person, but I guess I've decided to say that my rebellion is teaching as I do, and specifically teaching with hope and openness. So the sustainability challenges facing communities and the world as a whole, they're really significant. They're very complex. And so addressing them isn't the work of one individual, you know, not kind of adopting a naive position. But at the same time, the fastest, most surefire way to ensure that we fail to address them is if we slip into the beliefs that change is impossible, that there are no alternatives, and that escalation of these challenges is either like inevitable or beyond our current capabilities to prevent. And I position my teaching in direct opposition to these beliefs. I teach to open up new worlds of possibility through ecological economics and to empower my students to engage with that possibility in whatever forms seem best to them.
That's a wonderful, hopeful answer. So for any lecturers in ecological economics that have been listening to this and are interested in applying any of the techniques that Corinne has spoken about, I encourage you to get in touch. Corinne gave a talk on pedagogy at the European Societies Conference in Pisa last year that I know helped a good few lecturers bring new techniques into their teaching. So many thanks to Corinne Balcombe for joining us today. And thanks to all of you for spending time with us.
Thank you for listening to the podcast series of the European Society for Ecological Economics. If you like the conversation and your work is related to ecological economics in any discipline, consider becoming a member of our society to stay connected. If you are ready to discuss the topic, join our Facebook group called European Society for Ecological Economics.